You're listening to Conversations on Strategy. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I'm talking with Dr. Conrad C. Crane and Dr. Brian McAllister Lynn today. Crane is the author of Does the All-Volunteer Force Have an Expiration Date?, which was published in Real Clear Defense in January 2023. Lynn is the author of A Historical Perspective on Today's Recruiting Crisis, which was published in the autumn 2023 issue of Parameters. Welcome to Conversations on Strategy.
Glad to be here.
Me too.
Dr. Crane, please give us a brief recap of your article.
I did it back in January after running into some concerns about force structure. I went back and looked at the President's Commission on the All-Volunteer Force in 1970 and found that Thomas Gates wrote in the final report that the commission unanimously believed that the nation's interests would be better served by an all-volunteer force supported by an effective standby draft than by a mixed force of volunteers and conscripts. What he didn't say was that there was not unanimity in the viability of the concept. There were a number of people in the study group that just did not think it was something that either could get started or could last. Eventually, the program became immensely expensive. Without counting Social Security payments to veterans retirees, pay and benefits for DD personnel and veterans now accounts for about 15% of the total federal budget, and it's an even larger percentage of discretionary spending. After 2010, DOD did a bunch of reforms because of the rising costs, cut back morale, welfare, and recreation activities so they're forced to pay their own way, did a bunch of other things. And there's been a lot of concern expressed by other groups about the impact of eliminating thousands of service medical billets. A 2021 survey by the Military Family Advisory Network revealed that only about 63% of military and veteran families would recommend military life, down from 75% 2 years earlier. There's been this big change in the advertising approach. The Army's approach has gone the furthest toward presenting service as just another job. And I guess the question is, why should American youth pick a job that can get them killed or injured if it's nothing really special? The perception of the broken veteran permeates our culture. Quinnipiac poll earlier this year, when asked the question of Americans whether they'd be willing to defend the homeland if it was attacked by Russia, about 40% of total respondents said they would flee instead. I'm just concerned. My own opinion is while the all-volunteer force might not have an imminent expiration date, I think it has a reduced capacity to generate the manpower, and I'm not sure it can sustain current force levels. And since I did the article in January, there's some other things that have happened as well. I had a student do his research project here looking at the IRR and found that it's basically broken. The Army continues to have great difficulty recruiting combat arms. Drafting women was actually in both versions of the defense bill that was passed last year, but when it got to conference committee, it was removed. But that's an issue that's got to be resolved as well, and it won't be pretty. So those are just some summaries, I guess, of what my approach is.
Dr. Lynn, your article also deals with recruiting. Please tell us about it.
I was concerned that so much of the debate on the recruiting crisis was so fixated on recent headlines and lacked any real historical context. You know, pundits were denouncing wokeism and vaccine mandates and discrimination and abuse and other current controversies without any understanding and, to be honest, without any interest in whether there were deeper problems that went far beyond the present. And so I wrote this essay to challenge that presentism and make readers aware that the volunteer army has faced numerous recruitment crises. But the recruiting problem emerged over a century ago with what contemporaries called modern warfare. By 1900, success in a major conflict with a rival great power required the mobilization of the nation's personnel, financial, industrial, scientific resources. Victory just required much higher levels of managerial and technical and educational and physical skills in both peace and war, because you had to prepare for war. And the armed forces had to changed the recruiting and training and retention priorities, and that threw them into competition with a civilian market that needed the same skills. At that point, the Army has to contract its labor force. It either has to recruit already skilled labor, which it has seldom been able to do, or it has to train and retain that skilled labor, which means starting out at 18-year-olds and hoping that you can train them and keep them in there. And that's gone on now for close to 150 years.
Clearly, recruiting's not a new challenge for the Army. What inspired you to write about it now?
My biggest concern was looking at the reduced levels of requirements and how difficult it still is. And also looking at Europe, what really struck me in the early part of this year was looking at the problems our European allies were having. In 2003, the British could put in a division and sustain a brigade. Now the most they can get is a brigade and they can sustain a battalion. The French have about 90,000, but if they go to war, their logistics capabilities are very reduced because they're going to rely on us. The Germans are basically inept. My focus came from looking at this depletion in European capabilities as well as the war in Ukraine continues to expand.
I look at less contemporary issues. I think just as an outsider that the armed forces are demanding higher and higher levels of skills at a time of low unemployment and a diminishing number of young Americans who have those skills. And I say this as a university professor that interacts with them. Sometimes it seems that the armed forces, in particular the Army, seem to be pursuing contradictory, even self-destructive policies. For example, most of the Army marketing to me as an outsider seems to be an emphasizing that soldiers will be engaged in combat without much reference of serving the nation or personal benefit, which traditionally has been the main recruiting incentive. You used to look at everything from that misbegotten television advertising program that had soldiers in a helicopter shooting up some Middle Eastern village for no discernible reason, to the controversial Army combat fitness test, Site FM 722. Physical readiness is the ability to meet the physical demands of any combat or duty position, accomplish the mission, continue to fight and win. Okay, great. But then I look at what are the Army's most high demand MOSs? Only two of them, Special Forces, which requires language proficiency, and Air Missile Defense Crew are in the combat arms. If I was one of the other three, a potential 37F psychological operations specialist or a 25P microwave systems operator, I can't see why I would be attracted to an organization that considers my ability to carry a fully armored up comrade 50 yards as a prerequisite, or to be blunt, a suitable standard to measure my competence or promotion prospects. And they're doing this recruiting and marketing in spite of evidence that Kahn explained that a primary disincentive for military service is getting physically hurt. I mean, I worked construction. I was a union member. I never saw a construction firm advertise for workers on the promise they would be exposed to toxic chemicals or industrial accidents. It seems counterproductive to me.
What makes the current recruiting crisis different from those of the past?
The Army has continued to shrink. If you looked at all-volunteer forces first being considered, the Army's a lot bigger than it is now, and it goes down a lot in size in the 90s. It's a smaller force. And I'm also concerned because our allied forces, especially in Europe, are also much smaller. Looking back at history, if you look at what happens to the Roman Empire, they go through a similar process where eventually most citizens don't want to serve. They end up going with a much larger force of mercenaries from other places. And of course, that has a pretty significant impact on the Roman Empire later. There just seems to be this decline in willingness to serve. Perhaps there'll be an upswing again. There are patterns that employment is high, jobs become more scarce, maybe it becomes easier to recruit. Just looking at the smaller numbers and what's going on, I just think that there are things about this particular crisis that are different and are going to have different solutions, different implications down the road.
I agree in some ways with Kahn that the Army is at a crossroads. I would say it's been at a crossroads in other historical periods. There is this traditional martial culture, you know, rugged warriors led by charismatic military geniuses that goes back as long as the service has been in existence. That image, of course, has been co-opted in part by the Marine Corps, but it's seldom been an effective recruiting or retention image. The Army has sometimes sold itself as adventure, but for most of the time, it sells itself as an occupation that attracts a certain type of person that's interested either in self-improvement or patriotism or adventure. The problem is, and this appeared in the 1976 study that they did, is that most of the incentives that bring people into the service, getting out of an unstable home life or an unacceptable home life, seeking adventure or national service or learning a skill, usually have been accomplished after the first enlistment. I mean, the Marines used to have an incredible turnover. Now they've recognized that's no longer sustainable. But keeping those skilled positions as opposed to 18-year-olds that you can crank out at the age of 22 with skills that you can then teach another 18-year-old, that's a very tough position. And the problem is, as you increasingly get more high tech as you increasingly demand higher physical standards. I don't think Audie Murphy could have passed the current Army combat fitness test. You're looking at things that have been decided by a bunch of physically fit 50-year-olds based on maybe a standard that doesn't exist anymore. What do you need? If you want someone to fly a drone, they don't need to carry someone across a street in full armor any more than you need to do that for all sorts of other skills.
I actually made a pitch like that a few years ago. I was in charge of a group looking at physical fitness requirements for the Army, and we made a big pitch for different physical fitness standards for different skill sets and made that pitch to General Perkins and started to make some impact with him when all his younger subordinates said, no, everybody's got to be able to do the same physical stuff and we can't have any exceptions. And we got basically put down pretty fast. I agree with you.
Dr. Crane, you note that while the all-volunteer force might not have an imminent expiration date, it does have a reduced capacity to generate manpower that might not sustain current force levels. Please expand on this idea for us.
It's interesting. If you look at the recruiting figures, we can meet some areas. It's the combat arms. It's the infantry and armor. Combat skills are the ones that they're having trouble filling. If you look at a campaign motto of be all you can be, well, if you get to be all you can be, it probably isn't to go get yourself killed. It's probably to go in something else. The Marines, it seems to me, have really dominated the real combat motivation. You know, if you're going to fight, be a Marine. The biggest problem for me looking at recruiting right now is the combat arms, and we can't meet our quotas. The locations of that are still unknown. My focus is really on mostly now combat arms because we seem to be filling the other skill areas, but we just can't meet infantry and armor. We just can't seem to meet those criteria.
I'd love to hear your thoughts as well, Dr. Lin.
Combat arms are traditionally the ones that no one wants to go into. And to point out in my article, people might come into it, but they don't want to stay there because physically, it's a young person's game. And at the age of 22 or 23, you start looking around and saying, well, I'm going to transfer into something that has skills that I can apply, hopefully for a long military career. But if I can't, I have them for a civilian career. I think one of the first lessons is let's stop blaming recruiters and recruiting organizations. If you have a problem that goes back a century and a half, it's not caused by poor personnel or any reorganization, wire diagram, moving the ravioli around. I think it's really important to recognize that both past and current recruitment crises are dependent on factors that are beyond the U.S. Army's control. The economy, social attitudes, often political posturing. Does anyone want to join an organization when some clown flag-waving congressman can freeze your paycheck every election year? That's a big disincentive if you're a smart person that wants to go in. Every recruiting crisis is distinctive. People talk about, well, what about those traditional recruiting areas? And they sort of ignore the opioid epidemic that ravaged those areas. But I think it's also important to recognize their similarities as well. And if you really want to address the problem, you have to go back to first causes. At that point, you start recognizing, here's a contradiction. We need skilled labor, and we also need people in the combat arms. But we have to recognize that the standards are different. If we're going to be the nation's Swiss Army knife, then we don't all have to be that blade. We need to have a bunch of people that can do other things. Khan's right that they can never fill combat positions. On the other hand, if you look at the ones that they say that they need the most, 3 out of 5 of those are not combat. And the one combat position, you know, special forces, which you need languages. But the other one is the air missile defense people, because that's high skill. It's also combat. This is something I pushed Khan back on is, how long does it take to train an infantry person, and how long does that skill set need to be reinforced? If you have an infantry combat personnel at 20, after 2 years of training, is the skill set they need at 28 that different?
I would say it probably isn't, but the Army is involved in so many other things. Right now, they just can't get people to sign up for the combat spots for the infantry and armor. We got to get people in there so we can start to work this. I know there's a lot of other things going on in society at this time. If you read all the literature, when they come up with the whole idea for the all-volunteer force in the early 70s, it is always a stopgap. It's always a sense we got to have a strong draft to support this. The draft right now is kind of stymied. It used to be 13 days before draftees start to show up. Now it's 193. So they've expanded that gap. There's a lot of uncertainties about the way it's going to go. Again, we got to resolve the issue with women. I don't think we can ignore the fact we still need a viable draft. And how do we restore that is a struggle, I think.
I emphatically agree, as someone that studied the drafty army, that it's absolutely essential. You know, that's going to require a shift in attitudes as well. I came up in the age of the draft. I was the last year that they might have drafted. My friends and I learned a skill that was pretty well guaranteed, we hope, to get us out of the infantry, which is how to hide. So you have to accept that even when you have a draft, you know, you're going to have people gaming the system to ensure that they don't wind up getting in some dangerous job that's going to ruin them for life. I really think most of that dialogue about the draft really needs to go back and study that drafty organization. There's so much ignorance about that now.
Yes.
On both sides.
Yes, I agree with that.
Dr. Lin, you offer several lessons for everyone concerned about today's personnel issues in the U.S. Army. Will you share them with us, please?
I've gone back on that, and I got some feedback from my friends in the Army and so forth. I think at some point, there has to be some resolution. The newest Marine Commandant said, and I think that was a really interesting argument about, I will take personal responsibility to ensure this. I will take personal responsibility to ensure that. And I think at some point, the senior leadership has to become much more visible than it has been. I think that there's things that you can do. If you say, what we want to do is attract intelligent, physically fit, motivated people, the obvious place to do that is college campuses. And we have several people that come here for 1 or 2 years and decide that they really don't want to do this. And sometimes they just want to go and have an adventure and then come back and do this. So the obvious place to do that is push ROTC. You know, the citizen soldiers, not just officers, but the number of, and I speak as a military historian with colleagues, the number of contacts that the average person that teaches military history, which is ROTC required, will have with their Army ROTC professor of military science is minimal. I couldn't tell you who the one in Texas A&M is now, and I couldn't tell you who their predecessors were or their predecessors. I have more contact actually with the Marine professor of naval science than I do with the Army, despite the fact that Army is a much larger contingency. So when I looked at the success of the 1970s Army, one of the things they did was really start thinking about who we want in the service. And again, if you want a bunch of physically fit people that can carry guys around in full armor, that's a certain demographic. But if you want people with the intelligence, motivation, and so forth that are going to be career soldiers, if you're not going to have a 90% turnover or 100% turnover, which actually used to occur pretty routinely, you have to start thinking a little bit smarter about how to attract those people and get them into the service than flying in a helicopter and shooting up some village. This doesn't do it for people.
Dr. Crane, what are your thoughts?
I don't see these advertisements shooting up villages. I see advertisements where they're doing all kinds of other things, not combat related. I think we got to rethink the motivations. I hate be all you can be. I don't think be all you can be is what the Army needs right now. What the Army needs is something that talks about some of the things that Brian talked about this, you know, defending the country and service to the nation and kind of a much broader and more encompassing motivation for people to serve than just be all you can be. I think that's where we need to start. I think when the Army went back to that approach, that it was a big mistake.
I think a good motto might be, we take care of our own. Because if you want an identity, you want to belong to an elite team, and you want to think the responsibility goes both ways, and that you're part of this group of people that are all taking care of each other. And if you have, you know, a sort of break in that, where you're not aware, essentially, of the leadership, you're not aware of that team element, it's not an attraction. And Colin mentioned this, you know, that there is an awareness about the benefits are declining. Taking care of your own really becomes very important. And that's essentially driven by leadership coming down, inspecting, you know, being visible. I'm on the Marine Corps Board of Visitors. They took us to see their non-commissioned officers academy at Camp Pendleton, which is a disgrace. You know, that kind of generating an awareness of take care of your people, take care of you, I think would be something that might work pretty well.
I hate that we have to wrap it up, but I would love to hear any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share.
This has been entertaining as always. Brian, I would argue that there's a cyclical approach and it waxes and wanes, and we'll see. I just think that the size of the Army has continually shrunk. I'm particularly concerned about the impact on our European allies and what's going on over there. It's not just an American issue, it's a Western issue about service. I don't know where it's going, and I'm concerned. But I do think we in the United States need to really consider hard that the implications of reinstituting the draft, the drafting of women was in both versions of the Defense Appropriations Bill, the last one, and was taken out in conference committee. But I think we've got to wrestle with that issue, among other issues, about how we really sustain our military force.
I'm, as always, in screaming agreement with Khan. I think that we do have to reconsider the concept, not only the draft, but as of national service as well. It's in every decent draft. And the other thing we also have to recognize is what the draft was intended to do. And it wasn't to throw people into the army. It was a Cold War thing to channel American youth to national service. And if that was better served by being a physicist or a teacher in a high school, a clergyman, always exempt, farmers, the highest group that was exempted from the draft were farmers. As far as women are concerned, having taken martial arts in Hawaii with women who could beat me, I have no problem at all with drafting women. I think that that's fair. I draft other protected groups. I don't want to be like Israel, where you have a whole bunch of people that claim that they're divinely inspired, and that means that they don't have to serve. I believe in a real equal draft. And if you could get rid of the iniquities in the draft, and people would say, well, you know, it funneled poor people into combat arms. But in fact, it was pretty efficient at funneling people into what the military required them to do. And that's what you have to start thinking of it, is what does the military need them to do? Or what does the nation need them to do? And then push them into it. In that respect, it was fair. In terms of service in Vietnam, probably not. So I always point out there are probably more clerk typists in Vietnam at any point than there were combat infantry. We were certainly aware of. Those guys who were about to serve were certainly aware of.
Listeners, you can find Dr. Crane's work at realcleardefense.com and Dr. Lin's work at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Look for Volume 53, Issue 3. Dr. Crane and Dr. Lin, it's always a pleasure when I get to hang out with either of you, and both of you together is the best.
A lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you, Stu.
If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, you can find us on any major podcast platform.